Welcome to episode 3, the role of interoperability in trust, safety, and elections. 2024 is being touted as the year of global elections, with almost 50% of the global population across 64 countries and the European Union headed to the polls. In many of these elections, countries are using technology for photo registration, verification, and transmission of results, which has heightened concerns about the lack of trust in the electoral systems. There are data and system security concerns, systems are reportedly fragmented, leading to data inconsistency, and there's a lack of public awareness or education on the use of digital tools for voter processes. In this episode, we'll discuss how data interoperability can impact the way we approach technology-driven elections now and in the future. I've got two incredible people with me today. I have Katja Voigt from IREX, and I have Matt Bailey from IFES. But without hogging the mic, I will hand it over to them to introduce themselves. Katja, would you like to go first?
Thank you so much, Beverly. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Katja Voigt. I work for IREX and have been with this organization for about 11 years now in different roles. But what I do now has to be my favorite thing. I work on solutions to the challenges of information integrity, which is manipulative information and all sorts of manifestations of online harms, but also leveraging digital opportunity. And as a big part of that, I work on a couple of lovely programs that work to prevent and address technology-facilitated gender-based violence, especially as it targets women in politics and public life.
Awesome. Welcome, Katja. Thanks for joining us. Matt.
Hi. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here too. I'm in really good company. My name is Matt Bailey. I'm IFES's digital democracy senior advisor. So what that means is I sit in our DC office, but I work globally across our programs. My team and I work on kind of all of the digital democracy things. So that could be cybersecurity, information integrity issues related to what Katja is working on, and then often to issues like open data, digital transformation, digital public infrastructure, and so on. I'm excited to be here and share what we're seeing. It's obviously a big year for IFES and our work on elections around the world.
That's a perfect segue. Really, my first question to both of you is, we're almost through the year of the global election. How do you think elections and democracy more broadly have fared?
I think that if you read kind of any of the lay press or the publications that we all read every day, you see kind of a big sigh of relief. You know, there's still a lot of issues globally with trust in institutions, with voter turnout, significant issues continuing, as always, with inclusion for all sorts of different types of people around the world. But the big elections have happened. There hasn't been a giant meltdown, and we're moving towards the end of that year, at least according to the calendar. There's a lot of elections coming up in 2025, by the way. It's not like we're taking a breather. But I'll answer the question a little bit differently. I think we don't know how democracy is doing. One, there are those issues with trust, with turnout, with sort of confidence in democracy as a system that we continue to see across a lot of the important indicators maintained by folks around the world. But two, there's a general lack of data. One, we're suffering kind of a data void related to some of the major social media search providers where they've kind of taken a step back on transparency. So we really don't know the way we used to what's going on with disinformation, for example. Two, we have a really alarming situation with regards to the free press and the availability in most parts of the world of journalists who can make use of open data about elections or from government more broadly and get that out to an informed public. So have we seen a giant meltdown that some people were worried about related to AI, related to disinformation, related to rising authoritarianism? I suppose not. But do we really understand what's happening? I don't think so. And I think we're in a worse place even than the very bad place we've already been in for the last few years.
In my work on tracking disinformation trends and digital violence against women, I have a couple of insights that I will share that they're not very optimistic, I would say. So what I will say is that elections are interesting periods in any country's narrative arc because electoral campaigns reflect both the needs and also the direction of the country. And with these global elections, you can really look at what are these narratives globally. Are there similarities? What are these candidates saying? How are they treated? How voters vote? And what we're seeing from where I work with organizations around the globe on the issues of disinformation, gender disinformation, and online abuse is that these narratives are not very positive. What we are seeing is increase in gendered abuse. We're seeing the spikes in misogynistic narratives that resonate and that are being leveraged in coordinated fashion as a divisive issue in election. electoral campaigns. Women's rights, gender rights are being politicized and used as a juxtaposition of pro-democratic Western values versus traditional values by authoritarian regimes. And we see it across the globe, not just in, let's say, Kremlin sphere of influence, but also in Latin America and the Caribbean, definitely in countries that are influenced by China and Chinese agenda, across Africa, throughout the globe. I like to quote the part of the speech that was made by Samantha Powers at the CSW last year, which said the status of women is the status of democracy. And if that's the case, to answer your question, the status of democracy is not so great right now because this abuse is prevalent. It's underreported. The evidence is not comprehensive. But what we do know is really alarming because according to some studies, including the Economist Intelligence Unit, globally, 40% of women experience online abuse and 80% of women report witnessing online abuse against other women. And this abuse is higher for women who are in public roles, like female candidates, women members of parliament, women in public roles. In elections, this becomes especially visible, and this chilling effect that this has on other women's intent and participation in public spaces and in democracy is very significant. It pushes half the population out of participation. And I'll just wrap up to say that this discussion of gendered abuse as a trend has come up in conversations around climate change at the National Assembly in September, in national security conversation. It really shows how it spills just outside of democracy and human rights conversations into these other spheres now, and shows that yes, democracy, but also global security and national security and global issues such as climate change have been really affected by this.
Those are really stunning statistics. I don't think I knew how prevalent that level of online abuse had become. I'm glad you were able to pull those in. It's a really good quote in terms of if you want to know how democracy is doing, ask how women are doing. Matt, I'm going to start with you, but we'll come back to you as well, Katya. You'd started to talk a little bit about where technology fits as part of this broader conversation. So when we're thinking about candidates, when we're thinking about voter registration, we're thinking about turnout, how we tally results, have you seen examples over the last year of where technology has helped or hurt in this process?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a story just about this year. I mean, in my work, we often distinguish between elections technology, meaning the voter registration process and devices, the results portals and so forth, versus other technology that affects the election, which would include Facebook, for example, WhatsApp, Telegram, Signal, all the tools that are in the larger space. In terms of the election technology itself, the longer story arc, for those who aren't following it like us nerds are, has been towards digitization, often hybrid, meaning in some countries, folks want to hold on to sort of paper ballots and then use electronic tabulation of the vote. And then sort of it becomes a digital process from there. In some cases, there is sort of like a paper trail that's maintained in parallel to the digital trail, or certain parts are digitized, like the voter registration, meaning people using their thumbprint or other biometrics to sign in at the polling place versus the ballot process. So the overall trend has been towards piloting and then very cautiously moving into more digital technologies as part of that core process of voting and of administering the election. Speaking extremely broadly, what I'd say is that the narrative around digitization has gone from kind of a naive one, which we often see with regards to tech and democracy, including outside of the election, which is like, we'll digitize stuff and then people will trust it because it's transparent, or people will trust it because it's fast. We know who the victor is within 24 hours instead of within 2 weeks or longer in some cases. That's kind of the original narrative. As we get further into this process, which is a net good in most cases, we're finding that trust doesn't automatically follow from speed or from transparency. First of all, there's fundamental issues in many countries and communities in the tech itself. How do I know that this black box that the data is going into is true to my vote, especially because my vote has to be anonymous, so it's hard for me to look up, except in some regimes. And then we're seeing a lot of issues, not just this year, but in the past, a normalization of a political play, which is if there's any abnormality with the votes or any ability to hook a narrative to that, the first thing somebody does when they lose, even if they lost pretty clearly, and we've seen this in countries around the world, is they say, well, I heard the system was hacked. This becomes a place where you have disinformation about cybersecurity. And it's not necessarily foreign malign interference, as we sometimes say. It's not necessarily some of the autocratic or anti-democratic regimes and their intelligence services. It can just be the party that didn't prevail in the election. We've seen essentially like a normalization of that play of casting doubt on the election election technology itself. That's been part and parcel with sort of the politicization of elections administration. So there's not really a clean narrative about this year and elections administration technology, I don't think. The big narrative about technology going into this year, of course, was about AI. And this is going to be the year of AI and elections, and the whole world is going to melt because of deepfakes, completely notwithstanding the issues of tech-facilitated gender-based violence, online misogyny that Kaya was very clearly pointing out, and that it's deeply embroiled with AI and the availability of these as consumer technologies. We, of course, have not seen AI murder democracy this year. And in fact, some of the places where there was the most international concern about the weaponization for political purposes of AI, we've actually seen really interesting and messy deployments of the technology that are good or sometimes just really weird. And here, if you look at a publication called Rest of World that has a really cool 2024 elections tracker and elections and AI tracker, and they're just grabbing examples of elections and AI from around the world. And it kind of highlights the way that it's been a messy story. You've seen propaganda and disinformation like we sort of expect, and misogyny and other sort of hate speech happening. But you've also seen just weird art, protest, satire, emergence of memes in Sri Lanka, of deepfakes of politicians just absolutely gorging themselves on fruit. And this is apparently...
It's wild.
This is apparently like a trope for like, this person is corrupt. I mean, they're hilarious if you watch them. They're just objectively funny deepfakes and kind of hard to take issue with from the standpoint of democratic ills. What we've seen, I think, with regards to these emerging technologies this year is a really interesting hot mess of really bad stuff, including all of the misogyny and chilling of speech, chilling of marginalized communities' participation in public life, but also really novel, interesting, and just straight up hilarious deployments of the technology by people for protest and to vent and to try to kind of like recreate what political discourse looks like.
That's such a helpful frame. You've woven us through, you know, how speed does not guarantee trust, to how we see comedy, quite frankly, in the use of technology when interrogating how people feel about their candidates and how they vote. Katya, I'm curious if you have anything to add from that front. I think you did a really great job in your first response sort of walking through the ways in which tech-facilitated gender-based violence manifests in elections. But anything else that you've seen around how technology has helped or hurt some of these processes?
Yes, I will do that. But first, I really want to fact check myself. It was actually the US Vice President Harris who said the status of women is the status of democracy. So I apologize. But yes, on the technology and violence, I have to say we're still watching to see exactly what happens. Technology facilitated gender-based violence is a threat, and we know it, and it hurts women in real time. There are many examples from around the globe on how it's happening. Specifically on AI, I will say that there are some really alarming statistics and also just experiences that we have observed in our programs. And there is no comprehensive research. So everything I'm going to share is not researched deeply because this is happening right now and there hasn't been an investment in actually taking a much closer look. There is a statistic that 94% of deepfakes generated by AI are pornographic in nature. So that just tells you where that capacity of tech we have is going at the moment, and they prevalently target women. Other things that AI does, it definitely makes it easier to generate multiple very targeted messaging because it's much easier to just create a lot of prompts and saturate the space. Things like cybermob harassment are very easy to do when you have generative AI at your disposal. Image-based stuff is very tricky because a lot of the moderation that is built into social media platforms is mostly how we know when abuse is happening, is language-based. But because many languages do not have even the back end of the moderation built out properly, for example, country of Georgia, Georgian language does not have a lot of analytics back end built out. So when you're looking at moderation and looking at the statistics of online abuse or hate or disinformation, you're not going to get much, because there is not much analytics that comes back. And even when there is, it's mostly from language. But when AI generates images or deepfakes, videos, those often slip through the cracks because if you don't know the context and you don't know how it's coded, you're not even seeing the abuse. And what could look funny to us or innocuous, like polka dot imagery in Kenyan election context, actually is very politicized coded imagery that is targeting someone. And that's not my example. That's an example from a colleague of mine from policy, which is Afro-feminist tech movement, and they do a lot of really great research. And she used that example, and it was eye-opening to me because I would have no idea. I would not think that is something to track. Another example is from just us on Transform, which is a USAID program, the CSM Stand USAID program that prevents and addresses technology facilitated gender-based violence. We looked at some of the AI threats with our partners from the three countries where we work to demystify it and see how we can even leverage potentially AI and generative function that it has. And what we found is that it definitely learns from what humans put into it, and then it learns from itself. And the results can be hilarious, but also could be nightmarish. For example, if you put in a prompt into a free AI image generator that say, men elections technology, you will get something futuristic, but rather usable, depending on what your purposes are. If you do the same thing and you put women, you're going to get hypersexualized, very feminine looking, and disturbingly with signs on abuse on their faces, images. If you replace women with young women or a girl, God forbid, you're going to get a warning that image cannot be displayed because it is inappropriate. If you put something general like political leaders wearing red, you're going to get 85% male. If you're going to get women, they're going to be young, they're going to be old, not diverse. They're all going to be wearing something that's appropriate for a gala or a party, not a civic role. Their poses, their facial expressions are going to be subservient, not assertive, and they're going to look like they're being abused. So that's what you get with image generators. And why is it important? It's because people do use them. People use them to illustrate things. People use them when they search, when they play. And if we see it often, shapes how we think. For me, this is not just an immediate concern with this particular election year. It's just a long-term concern on how we are shaping our perception of what leadership is and how this technology not only learns from what it already has gathered online from what we humans have put in there, but how it's now learning from itself.
These are such poignant examples. I think the two things sort of join up, that it's the idea that elections are beyond this moment, beyond this year. I think that was the point you were really making, Matt, earlier on, and the point that you're making as well, Katya, with some of your examples, which is that, you know, it goes long beyond when the candidate applies. It's how we all think, how we grow up thinking about who a leader is and what they look like. It's the same way in which technology impacts not just the election of today. It's a constant investment in understanding how technology plays in so many complex ways in these ongoing processes. So to pivot a tiny bit, this season, we are the ultimate nerds at Development Gateway and IRX Venture, and we've been digging into interoperability. We've been defining it as joining up data and systems for better efficiency, for better decision-making, for better understanding of complex problems. The idea being that data on many different things, whether you're talking agriculture, livestock, or other things, sits in multiple places, and how do we bring them together so that people can see a clearer picture of what's happening? We don't often hear that word associated with elections, but it comes up. So Matt, how do you see interoperability? So again, the joining of data and joining of systems supporting democracy, if at all, through elections. Talk to us a little bit about how interoperability can show up.
Before I even dive into it, I want to go back to that first open data truism that transparency does not equal accountability. Openness does not equal usability. I continue to be a real believer in open data as a sort of critical infrastructure that enables some of those things to be possibilities, but it's kind of like correlation does not equal causation. Openness doesn't actually lead to integration of data sets. It doesn't lead to use of any of those data sets. It doesn't lead to change. With that in mind, again, just to kind of call back to those two different spheres of technology with elections, kind of the elections tech itself, the stuff that's used to administer the vote versus the larger technical environment. In theory, what we should be seeing as we digitize more elections and we kind of work with the big vendors who are providing a lot of that election technology is a movement towards interoperable elections data. Elections commissions around the world, we say EMBs, elections management bodies, have wildly different mandates. They have wildly different capacities in terms of data and technology. The registration procedures are different country to country, but they're all kind of within a larger community of practice around the world that's been paying attention to these issues and what is best practice for a long time. So what we'd really like to see is, as we digitize, that the data sets sort of become global and longitudinal. And I don't think we're seeing a lot of that yet, or we don't really know what we would do with that data. Like, what does it look like to compare granular voter data across years and continents? How do we link that up? But what we do see is a bunch of parallel issues that election commissions do work on or are sort of aiding within their space related to anti-corruption. So here, many elections commissions have an important role in overseeing political finance, meaning political parties and campaigns often have requirements to tell them like where the donation's coming from and where are we doing, in some cases, advertising buys, like where is the money going to for the political campaign, where did it come from? This has become really, really important, just full stop, in terms of looking at sort of dark money, as we'd say in the US, but just sort of where is political finance coming from domestically, internationally, and trying to tie that to transnational corrupt money flows and how that ties up to some of the larger sort of authoritarian and kleptocratic strategies that are affecting democracy around the world. And then specifically, I mean, my program, we've been looking at the subset of that problem, which is online campaigning transparency. So what that means, to de-jargon it, is ad buys largely on Meta and on Google's ad services. Those are the big two, on behalf of or by political campaigns. And here, you know, we spend a lot of time kind of rehearsing where we need those big companies and others to do more. But here's a place where we do need them to do more, but they've done quite a lot. So they maintain ad libraries, not for all countries, not totally equitably, but there are for many countries pretty good open data resources and an increasing ability to link the data between those resources. And then what we'd like to see is then that gets further tied to beneficial ownership data and tied into regulatory regimes related to that, and then tied into multilateral fora where we're looking at these issues and how to help each individual democracy and each individual election commission protect the ground rules for their democracy, but as a shared common interest globally. So that's one of the places I think where interoperability is really, really important, is kind of on that policing the rules of the campaign. And that's a place where it feels very actionable, because this is online campaigning, advertising buys. These are places where we don't get so immediately worried about free expression. This is speech that we agree should be regulated speech. And so we're kind of, as a global community, the anti-corruption side, the election side, and the corporate side, tech sector, we're trying to really knit those things together in the hope that in the near future, we can do a lot better job telling the story of sort of dark money and elections as not just elections interference, but as a corrupt activity that's tied into that legal and regulatory apparatus internationally.
It gave me goosebumps. I'm already like, when is that book going to come out? When is that documentary going to come out so I can read or watch? Because I think it's such an important issue and it's global reaching. It matters whether you're sitting in the US or whether you're sitting in Kenya or Nigeria or elsewhere. So Katia, from your perspective, as we're thinking about this increased joining up of data and systems for elections, I would love for us to talk upfront about the impact on women and girls instead of doing it and then realizing that it has a negative impact on these communities. So can you talk about what that could look like?
There's definitely impact, and it gets back to something that Matt was saying as well at the start of his answer. It's not just about having tech and systems and data. It's about who gets to access it, who gets to participate, whose data is reflected accurately and whose data isn't. And if we are trying to analyze trends and make predictions, are we using information that already contains a lot of inequities in it? So I think that if we are trying to kind of join up the systems and make analysis, there needs to be a red teaming or some other process that happens at the same time that builds in some almost like safety by design in terms of you're building a system, what are the check marks you're building in to prevent potential harms?
It's like designing responsible processes.
Right, designing responsible processes, making sure that you are protecting the data, you are accounting for data bias, you are not projecting the data bias, you are securing data privacy. And I can see this being really difficult to do on a global scale or even regional scale because of such inequitable provisions that exist around data and privacy and the use of data from platforms, from national systems. It just seems like a giant mess. And I really struggle to think on how we can design something that will fit all of these different potential contexts where in some places you have very strong online safety regulations, for example, and data protection policies, and in others you have nothing and there's no dynamic that would enable these contexts to develop more strong policies, or there's not a political will to do so. And in that case, anything that will result as a kind of catch-all will be extremely watered down. But that said, I don't think it shouldn't be attempted, because even this exercise can reveal the gaps and the needs and the existing inequities that are built into this landscape of data access, political public participation, which can create an agenda for action? So I know it's an extremely vague answer, but it's just such a big question. So I hope that my answer helped.
No, I think it's perfect framing because we are discussing elections globally, but so much of these are colored by what's happening at a national and subnational level. So when we think about appropriate responses, when you're talking content moderation, when you're talking managing campaign finance or political financing, it does have to start at quite a concrete level. Sort of the global principle making isn't as helpful if we really want to be responsible or designing responsibly some of these processes. So I think that's helpful to anchor in that way. It's come up a lot around elections are really fundamentally about trust. Do we trust our leaders, our systems, and ultimately, do we trust each other? Where do you see joined up data and systems helping to build trust or breaking that trust down?
I can maybe start and talk a little bit more about the fact that not everyone has the same voice and not everyone has been at the design table as some of the systems have been built. And I'm not just talking about women and girls. I'm talking about general population in many places where there is no transparency about how the electoral process is happening, what systems are in place. And so that lack of trust in what already exists and what has been the norm informs the dynamic for whatever is going to come next. And for us to kind of rebuild that trust, especially if new technology and new interoperability is being deployed, for example, in future elections, it really needs to be something that we start working on now for the next election cycle. And it needs to start with a kind of not whole of government or whole of anything, but whole of society conversation and awareness campaigns about what is the status of technology, what are its current shortcomings, how do we overcome them together, how do you as a individual citizen benefit from it and use it? How do you access those benefits? How are they made equitable and inclusive, these technologies, and build time for people to develop trust around these processes? And also at the same time, build resilience to manipulation, because Matt, you mentioned this as well. You don't even need to break the process or hack the system. You just need to threaten that you did to destroy that trust. That's what we see a lot in kind of authoritarian regime campaigns that are often not built on even credible cybersecurity threats. Just saying that they have manipulated an election is often enough to completely destroy the trust that the outcome is legitimate. And so I would say that there are two things. One is kind of taking a little bit of a longer period of time to build that trust and transparency of the processes and communicate those through trusted communicators, the electoral commissions and electoral officials and others before the election cycle starts. And there is a frenzy around narratives and people are making decisions about candidates. And when the manipulation around the process comes around, they're completely confused. And at the same time, keep building that critical thinking and digital and media and information literacy resilience to manipulation, preparing societies for the fact that there will be narratives specifically targeted at destroying that trust in whatever process you have. Technology is extremely vulnerable to manipulation as a narrative because for a lot of people, it is a black box and will remain so. And so unless you explain technology really well, a lot of the population will not understand how it works. And even when you do, there will still be some people who will not understand how it works. So that resilience to recognizing signs of manipulation and who benefits from them has to come hand in hand with explaining how the tech and all of the interoperability and all of these other things work together and why they're important. And that kills two birds with the same stone. You can actually build up the trust in the process and the use of data. And you can also build resilience to broader disinformation narratives that target specific agendas, that target specific candidates, that is also going to result in a more informed decision, not influenced by someone else's malign agenda.
I can't just agree with everything that Katya says.
I know. I was nodding so vigorously. That's the thing that podcasts miss out. You don't get to see my reaction.
I think there's sort of two issues here. I mean, one is if you sort of zoom out to the global stage and like the international community and issues like transnational corruption, transnational norms, transnational regulation that I was talking about, interoperability is a clear enabler of some of those things. Like how else effectively are you going to get the data collated in one place so you can get a picture of the games that are being played by bad actors at global and transnational scale? But zooming in, the issue with open data / interoperability, which I tend to use pretty interchangeably, at least in this general context, it's the same thing with technology in general, which is like it doesn't only create upward accountability, meaning like government or those in power are more accountable to the people. Sort of by default, it amplifies existing power relationships. So if you just throw a bunch of interoperability and availability of data into a context where the populace doesn't have good media, trusted information intermediaries to digest it and say, here, let's create awareness so now you can organize, now you can get out the vote. If you just throw transparency interoperability into spaces where those who are sort of economically already in power or the elites or the corrupt, whoever it is, have the practical ability to use it, you've just made business good or bad or legal or illegal more seamless and faster for those people. So you've actually increased the differential in power. You've decreased the ability of the populace to catch what the heck's going on because the bad guys or just those who have power, which isn't necessarily all that bad, are moving even faster than they were before. My worry if we start trying to connect this to trust and do people trust that the system or electoral outcomes are going to serve their interests is the less accountable the powerful are via the existing social structures, via journalism, via usability of data for upwards and lateral accountability, the less likely they should trust the system because those who have that power, who have access to that data, are likely to use it for purposes of self-interest and sort of self-entrenchment. I mean, I'm a fan of open data. I'm a fan of interoperability. I love good technology that works. I love decentralization of markets. I don't like it when you have sort of walled gardens and you get stuck with one provider because they're the ones you chose through some procurement process in 1985. But this is like radioactive material. So we really need to treat it with respect and say, when you're dropping transparency or interoperability into a system where there's big inequities in education, in access to power, in access to government, in access to political machinery, what's that going to do? I'm talking about political economy analysis. I'm talking about analysis from the margins, coming back to the exact same point that Katya was making, which is like, if you're going to introduce interoperability or open data, you better darn well be pairing that with really targeted and thoughtful education campaigns, capacitance, and just direct financing to civil society groups and journalists to make sure that that's going to be taken up in a way that's helpful rather than harmful.
Well said. We've talked throughout the episode about how this is a moment in time that we're talking about elections and democracy and online abuse, but this has long-reaching implications looking forward. But I'm curious from both of you, what is something that gives you hope about how technology can be used for good when we think about an ideal use of data and systems together in elections? What gives you hope?
Like, I've been really honored in a couple of different roles to get to do some front lines research, meaning going and talking with individuals who are some of those marginalized individuals or representatives of marginalized communities, LGBTQ activists, persons with disabilities in parts of the world where persons with disabilities are disenfranchised, dishonored, and disrespected, internally and externally displaced persons, members of marginalized religious and ethnic groups. And the shocking thing to me is almost universally, when you talk with them about social media, talk with them about Facebook or other tools, the narrative I generally hear is like, yeah, there's tons of abuse and everything's really dangerous. That's my life, though. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for these tools, I wouldn't be able to be a member of my community. I would have nowhere I can live my identity. So here I'm thinking of like a political activist, a person with albinism who I talked with in East Africa a few years ago, LGBTQ persons in a shockingly large part of the world. People are like, no, this is critical infrastructure for my life. It's really, in some cases, shitty or really dangerous or really fraught critical infrastructure, but it's the only space I have. So like the message is sometimes almost, please don't take this away, or like, please don't screw this up for me. So I'm giving you like the bleakest optimist answer I possibly can, I think. But I think that like what it does is it disrupts this narrative that's taken hold in some parts of the development human rights community. I've been on various fora kind of talking in this way myself, and it probably will continue to do so, that like the dream of the open internet has failed. But it's also like we can't even imagine what the world would look like, especially for these communities. And you sort of have to trust that testimony when you hear it over and over again. This has completely changed what's possible for me and my community. So I remain, for all of the winds that are buffeting us and the extremely real, I'm at pains to say I'm not trying to undercut the really, really alarming stats and stories that Koch is bringing forward. That is also true. We have to hold both of these things in our head, but it's like easy to lose sight of how critical technology has been and continues to be for these voices, and that their life was going to be dangerous without the internet. Like, it's not actually determinant of whether the life is dangerous. It's a shift in the context and the type of danger they're facing. So I think there's optimism to be found there, even if it's a highly qualified one.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. This has given me a nice foundation to build on. There are a couple of things that even professionally give me optimism in this space. And one is this recognition, you can't separate. We do not live in real life and online. Our existence right now is digital, physical, intertwined. How we are treated in digital spaces and what we experience there informs how we act and feel and decisions we make. And we can't just pretend that we can just minus technology and things will be okay. You encounter people and machines digitally all the time, and we're figuring out how to do that. And we haven't quite sat down as humanity and said, okay, well, we figured out how to engage in person. We have rules of civility. We have this and that. We've started doing this in bits and pieces digitally, but we don't have norms of engagement laid out specifically. This is how you behave. And so we're figuring out something. And I'm optimistic because I'm seeing that resilience is a constant thread, even when we work on a program that is specifically designed to address violence. Our partners in Georgia and in Guatemala who ring the alarm bells about the AI and all the horrible things that they do, they take that same AI and they use it to create moderation strategies that are machine enabled and do not rely on human processing once they train it. And that's, I think, what the optimism is and why the election period is also important, because as I mentioned, I do believe that election periods, they highlight what's important in society. And they highlight the big threats and they also highlight the big opportunities. So I think there are more discussions around who is at the design table than have ever been before in terms of inclusivity of new technologies and systems and data. And for me, this is a reason for optimism, and it's bumpy and it looks very scary, but it's important to not get very pessimistic about it because we want to be able to come out of it. That's the whole reason for this conversation, is we highlight the threats so we can act on them.
Thank you, Katya. Thank you, Matt, so much for a really intentional and thoughtful conversation about what this looks like. And thank you more broadly to our listeners who've joined us for this episode. We've been discussing the role interoperability plays in trust, safety, and elections. If you'd like to listen to our earlier episodes and read our latest white paper on demystifying interoperability, please click on the link in the bio.
This episode was produced by Wakini Njogu, Anna Tutor, and me, Beverly Hatcher Mbu. It was edited by Joseph Wagner and Wakini Njogu. Our theme music was created by Mark D. Hatcher.